Hello and welcome to the Tech Bytes Audiocast. My name's Tim and I'm from the Oak Bytes Blogger Zine, and with me is Dr. Roy Shestowitz from the Tech Writes website.
It's Friday night and I'm gonna get sauce. I fought the troll and the troll lost. I fought the troll and the troll lost. He tried to boss me and was outbossed. I fought the troll and the troll lost. I fought the troll and the troll lost. Underneath his creeper bridge, hoping goats will cross. Quoting Ashcroft and Tom Ridge.
Hello and welcome. This is the Tech Bytes Audiocast. It's April 13th, 2014, and I'm back from a one-year hiatus, or possibly more. Thank you for downloading the audiocast, and I think we'll get on with the show. And Roy, I'd just like to say it's very good to be back.
It's good to have you back. I mean, I spent the past almost 1 year just mostly doing shows with Richard Stallman. Well, I cannot really complain about it, but it was just a way of keeping the show going in some form.
So it's been an interesting year, and a lot of changes. And I'm currently busy with my second novel, although I'm still waiting for my first one to be released. And yes, I've been very, very busy in my personal and in my professional life as well. So it's thrown very quickly, and I'm looking forward to get back in the swing of things. Possibly next couple of months when things settle down, I'll be back on the show. But it's very strange because it doesn't seem like I've been away at all. And apart from a different show of sorts, it's pretty much the same as it always was. So with that in mind, I expect you've got a plethora of topics.
Yeah, we really have an abundance of topics to chat about. As a bit of background, you and I spoke a week ago, last weekend I think, or Friday, something like that, and we were going through the things we were going to cover, and obviously some personal things, but that's not for the show, family related stuff. But the point that kind of occurred to me is there's so much stuff that's been happening. We never touched it. We never expressed an opinion on it. And a lot of things tend to be repetitive when you mention them time after time, but slight variations each time you bring up a topic. But in this case, since we haven't done a proper show in a while, we've got the UK policy, for instance, pro open source policy and pro ODF policy to speak about. We've got all sorts of news about Nokia. We've got things to do with Yola. I don't think we ever covered Yola properly on a show. Firefox OS. If we want to speak about Mozilla, I suppose we can also talk about all kinds of gossip and things that don't have much to do with technical issues. And, Amazon surveillance. We barely covered any of the NSA stuff. We did cover a lot of the WikiLeaks stuff when we started the first season in 2010, but we haven't really mentioned much of the GCHQ and NSA stuff. So I think the next few shows will be quite interesting because there's plenty we can cover, and we don't even have to plan a show. We can just bring up a topic and go and flow with it.
Yeah, it's definitely been changed for me as well. My desktop habits, for want of a better word, have changed. I'm now virtually completely in the cloud. I'm currently running this Mumble software through Peppermint 4, and that's merely virtually just a cut-down version of Ubuntu with a browser front-end shoved on it. With my work that I've been doing recently, I found that my needs have migrated me by, not by choice, but by necessity to the cloud. So I've got a very different take, a slightly different take on a lot of subjects which I had a strong opinion on.
So one thing we could start talking about, I mean, this is not really an argument we had before, and you just mentioned it yesterday, and I think also a week ago, some of your browsing habits and your work habits when it comes to so-called cloud. And what I do realize is that this is not really a new thing for you. You were promoting various things like Peppermint even a few years back, and these are operating systems that were built around what we now know to be things that are tightly integrated with Prism and some of the programs of the surveillance networks. So the one thing that I wonder if you've seen is Condoleezza Rice is now on the board of of Dropbox. And her role officially, or at least based on the announcement, is that she will be in charge of privacy. And are you still there?
Yes.
Yes. So here you have a person that I don't think people quite realize played a significant role in promoting ICANN, and back in 2005, and I recall this from memory, was lobbying very hard to keep the control of the internet under the U.S. government's wing. So she has a lot to do with the surveillance, not just with the torture, but many people concentrate on the fact that she was pro-torture. And so I've been writing now for almost a year about how Dropbox is exceptionally dangerous because of prison. But even before that, I was warning people in terms of service. Terms of service are basically changing. People have to accept them or be prevented from accessing their files. And this is not the only thing. Of course, almost everything you can say about Dropbox, which doesn't use encryption, you can say about all the other services like this G Drive, and I think Microsoft calls it Live Drive. And why would people want to give away their files for supposed cheap storage and bandwidth?
Yeah, it's a very good point, and like I say, my views probably on the cloud are slightly altered over the years, especially now. If you look at Google Drive, for example, that's what I'm currently using, and you look at the sort of prices, it works out at about, at the moment, I think $199 for 100 megabytes, sorry, gigabytes, and that equates to about £1.40 currency. For people like myself, and I'm using GDocs at the moment because it's very handy when I'm typing up my novel and doing an edit, that other people have real-time access to that document. It saves a lot of time, me being able to see the corrections that they want made, notes put into the margins for what they want to see or what they don't want to see. So for that type of service, there is no real open source equivalent for me. Yes, sure, I could use it one of the open source Office suites, but I don't get direct access to Google Docs. However, I will counteract that in a second with something else that I recently have been trying out. I've always had issues with storing data on the cloud in terms of people's privacy, and I wouldn't want to cheapen anybody's concerns about privacy. Of course, there are many people out there who have completely silly notions about what the government is doing and not doing, and I'm not talking about the concerns that we get these days of government intrusion into people's data, because that has happened and we've obviously seen that being reported in the press. But there comes a time when, for example, like me, I've collected a massive digital photographs. In fact, I can't remember the last time that we took something down to the Photoshop to print and get a physical copy of. I think a couple of pictures of the kids for the wall, but that was about it. And so all my kids' pictures and all the family pictures all need to be stored somewhere. And I can store them on a CD-ROM or a DVD, whatever. And I can store them on a hard disk and SSD or whatever. But the nice thing about having them on a Google Drive or something similar is the fact that I'm almost guaranteed that data's safe. And I know there's been issues with Google, and I know it's possible that the files can be deleted and corrupted and stolen and whatever. But I've got to look at it as risk assessment, and I've got to decide whether the risk of putting them on there counteracts the risk of not putting them on there. And for me, having those documents, and I have broken DVDs with all my pictures on before, and I have had the need to go to the Google Drive and use that backup to get all my photos back again. And also the fact that I can access it anywhere. I don't have to take a disk with me. I don't have to take a USB stick or anything like that, which is another convenient tool. I mean, I don't have any concerns about privacy, because the type of stuff that I would put on there is the stuff that I don't particularly care if anybody in authority, in quotes, would look at, because it's, for example, my novel is on there. Now, if they want to steal that and start releasing it under their own name, then fine, they'll have copyright issues from my agent and my publisher, which is their concern, not mine. So there's nothing really personal on there. And I would treat the internet, in any case, or any sort of public service, telephone or a mobile phone or whatever, as not personal anyway. You put your data, you send your voice out onto the ether, and I always expect that somebody else is listening that you don't want to.
But the expectation doesn't make it okay. So
no, it doesn't,
what you're
no.
saying is you don't have the expectation. Should but we not change the law then yeah, to say that you should have the expectation?
But the problem is, and this comes back to GCHQ and the whole fiasco over the snooping of data. The problem is this: there's many people that are vocal. There's many campaigns. I can say, and we can all say this: nothing will ever change. The people that are the ones that are wanting to intrude on this data are not people that would be put off, stopped, prevented by law. The GCHQ example is great because, from what I understand of the whole case, and I've followed quite a few writers that I trust very much on the subject about the whole snooping of data. Now, we've got laws, privacy laws in the UK, pretty much as the Americans and any other country have their own privacy laws, and I don't profess to know them. However, what our intelligence services can do, and we've seen this already, is that they can snoop by proxy. So, for example, the American Secret Service, or whoever snoops, can snoop on British data and then pass the information back to the British without breaking.
Yeah, but this is old stuff. This is echelon.
But I
want to jump in just a few more points. So, one point I wanted to make as you were making it, you mentioned how much bandwidth is cheap for you in storage, but storage is not expensive, and bandwidth, you're paying for it, because the US currently, while we still have net neutrality, as far as I know, we do have it in Europe, and it seems like there is going to be legislation protecting it, you're paying for the data when you're using Wi-Fi or your home broadband, so that's just the model of how things are. So they're not really doing you a favor in that sense. The other thing is, GCHQ, since you mentioned it, and by the way, they don't just snoop on data, they snoop on streams. So they would even hook onto people's Yahoo chats, and as far as we know, is they watch like 100,000 people masturbating. That's what they found. And this is not really acceptable, because when they snoop on 1.9 million people, then you know they're not really spying on people who are very likely to be. You said things have always been the same, nothing has changed, but it's actually not true. Things have changed, because in the past they couldn't do all this stuff.
Well,
when the Pentagon, this thing called the Inter-Net came out from the Pentagon, it wasn't yet possible to do everything like that. There was no infrastructure, there was no backdoor. Instead of backdoor, it seems to be the new thing now to implant vulnerabilities in some software. We don't know enough yet, but I've done some investigation and it's still being discussed on the web. But it seems
the thing
that
is, sorry to interrupt, but the thing is, you know, and I've made this point in a few of my articles of late. There's no dispute that snooping into people's private conversations and habits or whatever is completely out of order. There's no dispute there whatsoever. And I think the millions of people who were intruded upon can feel rightfully aggrieved for that intrusion of their privacy. However, this is something that throughout history, and I've documented this before, has been done. Now, in the times of the Romans, because we didn't have the technology.
So in Kenya, when the priests did it in Kenya, they did destroy some evidence of it. Recently, I think they throw some evidence in near Singapore in the waters. They were very much limited in what they could do. This is the reason you have a nation now called the United States of America, because they were able to organize against the British.
I'm talking about the ethos of invading privacy. Now, technology has enabled people to do that simpler, and 1.9 million or however many people can be intruded on now. It's a click of a button, I assume, and a lot of data collected.
Not everyone. Here's the thing. So people can still use encryption, even though RSA and several other things are very much weakened by design. They were designed later or perturbed to be vulnerable and give the illusion of security, which is even worse than having no security at all, because you can say things that you wouldn't say otherwise if you thought that you were being eavesdropped on. But here's the thing, if you're when it comes to GCHQ, what you have to bear in mind, they have a very nice model of, we'll have CCTV everywhere. There is a robbery, there is a murder, we'll look back at the footage. Now, the footage, of course, is not going to prevent the crime. It might help catch the person, but yesterday when I was walking past the store and I watched one of those guys in a, well-armored vehicle, going to pick up some cash in one of the pubs. I was thinking of like a potential threat, because usually you would try to think why they do certain things at the airport and what they're trying to prevent and how they would prevent an actual case and an actual threat. And then you actually think to yourself of the CCTV and the fact that these days, as far as I know, from personal experience for people that I was a victim of and people nearby, people just, you know, they just wear some kind of a hoodie or something to hide their face. So the CCTV will keep on doing surveillance and people are not doing anything wrong. And as soon as the bad guy happens, for instance, the person who stole my bike last year, he's going to wear a hoodie and then it'll say some guy stole your bike. And except his skin color, they cannot see anything. They just see a guy with a hoodie taking my bike and walking away, and they can see it on CCTV. But it's not very useful. So the model that says, okay, we'll just catch those people and photograph their face is really breaking down, because those who plan to do bad things will still use, you know, reliable measures of avoiding those things. So who do you actually spy on?
Yeah, I mean, the problem is, and I mean, CCTV is probably a topic that goes way off course of what we're discussing, but I mean, in brief, CCTV is always one of those things that does it prevent crime? Well, we can't ever measure that, because you can never measure what has been prevented, because it hasn't happened. Mm-hmm. Of course, look, you're right, people can disguise and wear hoodies or whatever when they commit a crime and render mm-hmm. CCTV completely useless. That's not the only method of capture that CCTV would use, because of course it can be used to track an individual's whereabouts, and that's for good reasons and bad reasons. If they were following the guy with the hoodie who'd concealed his identity and managed to see him go into a car, for example, and number plate was shown, then that might lead. But again, it can also be used for the purposes which we've seen in reports where you've had bogus CCTV operators that have used it to infringe on people's privacy and use them completely inappropriately. Could I just add, though, it might interest you to know, in some of the bigger stores where they have CCTV on the outside, there's a lot of rules. I mean, I would assume this is the same in sort of any person who's got access to a CCTV camera, but even more so in the bigger sort of industries. There's very strict rules which people have to abide by in terms of privacy, for sort of zooming the camera in. You can't focus it on people's houses or anything like that. And because everything is recorded, there's a very good supervisory method going on if it is being supervised. I've got mixed feelings about CCTV, and I think what it does do, what we can say, is it does up the ante. If somebody, for example, your security corps or security money collector, if somebody was to commit a crime involving a robbery of him, the ante would be considerably higher, because now they've got a lot of prevention. They've got the locked van, they've got the security guard, they've got the box, they've got all that sort of thing. So they're going to have to go to more extreme measures in order to commit the crime. Now, that could well stop the average Joe criminal who might think, oh, I'll try and snatch that briefcase off that chap, and only attract the more hardened, determined criminal who's willing to go the extra mile, as it were, to commit the crime. That's arguably, but we can't really say, because we can't say what CCTV
is. It's important,
is,
so you're talking about deterrence as the issue, and I agree with you that I always said that one thing that CCTV might be able to achieve is deterrence, and it's really hard to measure that. So you might say people will be aware that the CCTV will act as a deterrence. However, it depends on deterrence against who. So a lot of people would be on drugs, and I'm not trying to generalize here, but a lot of people who commit crimes, they have strong physical urge to, you know, they have to do it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think a camera is going to prevent them from pulling a knife and trying to mug someone. And the other thing is, you have to distinguish between, you know, like classical crime or minor crimes and shoplifting and things like that from the issue of supposed terrorism. I didn't like how the press in the UK still plays around and, you know, really squeezes this cow that's the last year's, I call it homicide. However, they insist that this is a terrorism act, the guy slaughtered the guy, disgusting what happened there. However, to try to justify whatever it is they do, they will use this basically a failure of the system to prevent a crime to persuade us that we have this issue that's terrorism, and therefore we have to, you know, do surveillance of just about any British person and look at all the emails.
It's a very grey area. I mean, because what constitutes terrorism? For example, if there'd been a case which was tragically the same, where it was, say, two football supporters from an opposing team had done the same thing, would that still be an act of... Because terror is such an ambiguous title. It's something that isn't particularly well described by anybody in authority, and it's something that leaves the public sort of scratching their heads until they hear the word mentioned.
It's a very... Actually, we had this discussion today in the TechRise IRC channel, because somebody brought up the fact that insurgent is a very insignificant, nebulous term. And there are lots of terms like that, like, you know, militant, or, you know, which basically means adult male these days. And a lot of people don't realize that any adult male who can join the military is a militant by the definition that they use based on the New York Times. So the definition of an insurgent might as well apply to a country sending more troops to a country it invades. And you might say, well, they're insurgents, the surge of troops to the place. However, the way it's used is usually very deceiving, and terrorists is more associated with ethnicity now, and with a certain bunch of people, but you wouldn't associate Angela Merkel with terrorism, even though in the eyes of the people who look after her, they call her a target, or a person who's potentially an adversary, and they will spy using the same law and the same pretexts as they do for other people.
I mean,
and that's
sorry.
So it's I try to avoid those labels in theory. Sometimes use quotes around them because it's not really clear what those mean. Even when they claim to kill a so-called terrorist or a militant, a lot of the time you have to bear in mind the ones that they kill with the drones, and they kill a lot of innocent people, like drivers and, you know, bystanders and completely incorrect people based on their metadata that the NSA collects. A lot of those people have not done anything yet, but there is suspicion that they will be engaging in what the Department of Justice, I think it's Eric Holder, would define as suspicious activity and being an imminent threat. These are two things are in quotes. So they haven't done anything. However, there is suspicion that they're doing something suspicious, and they might be doing something bad soon. Therefore, without trial, we assassinate them, execute them, and people around them as well. And I write a lot about this issue of drones, because I think that opens the door to things which in 10 years from now will be applicable not just to arms, but maybe... as we see in the UK now, the xenophobia has been extended, in my opinion, from Arabs to East Europeans, and you see a lot of the anti-Polish and anti-Romanian thing. That shows you that it's a very easy victim to pick up. First, you pick up the people that look a bit different and have a tendency to be upset at the government, and then you extend to another group of people.
I mean, we're quite lucky, because at the moment where we live, it's a very diverse mix of communities, and we don't have any major sort of social issues here. Everybody gets on with each other, and there's no real problems. The worrying thing is as you go further north up the country, maybe where migration isn't so large, in some of the sort of northeast areas, it's parties, and I don't want to turn this into a political debate, but you get parties like UKIP and the BNP, which will say things which people will follow and which people will buy into, and then all of a sudden you have a large community blaming another community for all the wrongs of everything that's going wrong with this country, and it's nothing to do with the immigration at all. There's a very interesting article recently on London's Biggest Conversation, a very popular radio show in the UK. It's also available online around the world. And it's things like National Health Service wouldn't survive without immigration. It lives off immigration, and that's how we've got the National Health Service we have. And there's a lot of other benefits that's been brought to this country, but like I said before, ignorance and small-minded people being led by other people with ulterior motives always spells trouble.
You're suggesting the only people to lead the gullible are the ones that are the racists. However, remember that also the people who are further up the ladder, they use those people to incite the people to be distracted. So it's a bit more complicated than you put it.
It's not justifiable, but it's understandable. It's human nature to find blame somewhere else. I mean, we look at even the big cases, for example, something completely random now, Ian Huntley. When that story hit, Ian Huntley was arrested. He was a killer, by the way, for people that don't know. But the blame and the news reports after his arrest and trial were all about who was to blame. Was it social services? Was it the local police? Who didn't do this? Who didn't do that? Why didn't they do this check? And it seemed that the entire blame of the actual crime from the perpetrator was shifted onto all the services that surrounded this person that should have known that he was going to commit a crime later in life. And it's human nature to want to find somebody to blame. Unfortunately, when it comes at the detriment of a community, that's when it's wrong, and that's when it needs to be stopped. But it's something that's always going to happen, unfortunately. And I'm sure, you know, we've seen a shift of blame that goes around this country, you know, over the last 20 or so years, and it stays with different communities for a while, then moves on to another one, then you don't hear anything, and it's unfortunate. But you know, we try our best to sort of put a stopper on it and say, look, this is wrong, you need to reassess. But some of these people are just so set in their mindset that, oh, it's got to be this person's fault or that community's fault. And really, there's no getting through to them. I mean, one look on Twitter, I've regularly engaged people who are members of the EDL, which is the English Defence League, and their sort of attitudes and towards many different people is just absolutely disgusting. But you can't get through to these people.
These people represent an opinion that's shared among a lot of people. They might not be supporting the deal. So this is just showing one facet of people's opinion. So let's assume, just assume for the sake of argument, that every person's got some capacity to hate a different group. Every person's got a capacity to hate a person of a different class, like this person's got a boat and a house, blah, 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 so I don't like that person. And every person's got a capacity to hate, let's say, a different age, a different gender, a different occupation or something like that. And these things represent strands, and the fact that they organize into a group and manage to recruit people, those people are not therefore labeled. You know, I'm a UKIP supporter. I mean, there is an element of these opinions in many people's, you know, I share values also with horrible leaders like Bush and Obama to some degree. I couldn't say like every single thing they do I'm against. However, the growth of a certain strand and opinion, that may be a concerning, you know, and the same goes for governments. Governments have hostility either against the Soviets or against something like the Venezuela control of the, you know, the nation's control of the oil reserves, as opposed to corporations' control of the oil reserves. And they have certain attitudes towards that, and that changes over time.
Well, I think we've diverged quite dramatically from the original topic at hand. So I'm going to be the one to say. I think next topic, you've summed everything up quite nicely.
We were talking about storage online and yes. Usage of... yeah, which is fair enough, but I mean, these are things we didn't speak of before. Yeah. And the important thing is, I guess, that if you're storing your files away, and by the way, I store my files online on my website, it's still accessible to anyone who wants to access them, but I'm aware that it's public. I can proudly say my wife doesn't need to use Facebook because she puts her photos online, and over the past year plus, she got like 150,000 direct views on like the images, so people actually access and they view it, and they can subscribe by RSS. So we don't have to rely on any third party to distribute and to tag and to do things like that. Facebook, at least in an article I saw yesterday, is serving 2,000... should say transactions to UK police, and an article I saw last year said that the UK police is the third biggest user of Facebook. I think it's a lot more than 2,000 requests, the point is Facebook and sites like that are the to-go place for those who require information about you, including private communications, and it's obviously not the things that they would see publicly. What they want from Facebook is to see a lot more detailed information that Facebook would typically give to advertisers. What time is he using the computer? Who does he talk to? What does he say? Is he admitting something? Is he talking about his past, her past, who he likes, who she likes, whose wall that person visits a lot, and they can share this with authorities as well. And the more you give to those corporations that do cooperate like this with the NSA, you know, it can be used. It will only be used against you. You know that it's not going to be used to your benefit. Nobody's looking after you and trying to, you know, saying, "Oh, this guy's a great guy. We should send him a check by post and say thank you for being such a great Facebook user."
Mm.
They look for negative things. They treat everybody as a potential threat. And threat perhaps to, you know, he might become a political party one day and beat Labour and Tories or something. And this is their concern. This is their real enemy.
I mean, it does. You've brought up a few really interesting things there, because with Facebook especially, yeah, it's used. Obviously, the authorities will have a look on that. I think there was an article recently I saw that was reported in the press where there was some person who was wanted on a recall to prison, and he was bragging that the police hadn't caught up with him on Facebook. And then it got into this sort of silly, immature battle between the police and this person who was on the run, or for want of a better word. And they eventually caught up with him and put a gloating sort of comment on his Facebook page to say that don't challenge us, we will win, or words that I think it was Manchester Police actually. It was quite recently. I saw the article on the Metro, I think, but it shows that that all the agencies are using this. And the problem is as well with these social media sites like Facebook, which are the mainstream ones that the majority of people, if you're knocking the next door neighbor's house, are going to be reading or using. The government bodies now are using them themselves to promote their claims of greatness and what they've achieved, and they're using them as PR tools, which is one of the reasons why I'm systematically blocking all these type of bodies and agencies from my Twitter account, because I'm fed up of seeing things promoted on my timeline to say that how great everything is.
Do they call it sponsored now? Like,
yeah.
Sponsored?
Yeah.
And they really show me this. Yeah, it's a horrible thing.
Anything with of a government body, I will block.
They do it on Twitter as well.
So yeah, that's one of the amendments.
And Twitter is becoming more like Facebook, and this is something we didn't cover. And so far, they haven't changed the layout, default layout of pages, but they are moving very much in the direction. Now, I'll tell you what you should try, okay? Go to Twitter, I'm saying Facebook. It will be like Facebook. And occasionally you'll find, if you look at a person's profile page, it looks almost the same as Facebook. Mm-hmm. Go to direct message and look at the interface. That's almost like Facebook. Now, go to your settings. Okay, this is interesting. Go to privacy. They changed the... A lot of people didn't notice this because Twitter didn't say they changed the software, the backend. That's the magics of the cloud. And you'll find that you have... I'm not sure if it is something like an ID assigned to you, and that's not an ID for your use, that's for advertisers. And by default, it will be switched on. So it basically means that you're being tracked. And increasingly, Google does the same thing in Android for Android users. And there's all sorts of things that happen that are horrible when it comes to privacy. And I said Twitter is increasingly starting to treat users like products. And Stallman likes to call them not users, but used, because they're being used. And it goes down the same road now with Twitter, unfortunately, and I keep using it, but I just don't count on it for the long run.
Yeah, I mean, I use it, and I mean, I would advocate anybody using Twitter if they're fully aware of the consequence of using it. Now, I go into Twitter knowing that I'm going to be looked at as a product, and that's why we see the promoted posts.
Mm-hmm.
Have
you heard about the Wonga scandal?
No, I haven't heard of that.
Okay, so those who don't know, Wonga is a really, really horrible loan shark in the UK, and apparently they expand to other countries, because today I saw they also have like a presence in Canada or something, and they keep spamming us on TV and stuff, so it's very easy to hear this word Wonga every now and then. And somebody did a satire about the company, and then the company, apparently the company's lawyers, whom Wonga calls, like, you know, even Wonga thinks those lawyers are a bit crazy, and it's the people they employ, went after the person's post in Twitter, and Twitter agreed to delete, to censor the criticism, which was satirical. So it wasn't like even a, it was a bogus copyright claim against satire, against the company itself. So here you see that Twitter is also starting to go into the censorship business based on bogus claims as well.
Well, I never came across the Wonga story myself, but I mean, the other thing I was going to say was, and this was relevant to my own experience, it sort of highlights the shame of the experience I had with Diaspora. Now, that was the one way that you could sort of prevent a lot of these issues that arise with Facebook and people being given data by Facebook, and as it was decentralized, and it was fantastic. I mean, I think I said to you on Twitter a while back, the problem I had with Diaspora wasn't that it was bad service, wasn't that it didn't do everything it said in the tin and everything that Google Plus and Facebook did do, but it seems that the average user or demographics of the user base was mainly people in the know. And that's why I pulled out.
You don't want to be trolled by people who think you're crazy.
Well, but you see, I've got a lot to say, but my target audience or the people I want to stretch out to aren't the people that already know. Aren't the people that know about Creative Commons. They don't know about free and open source software. Mm-hmm. Now, it's all well and good me going to a forum and saying
it's
that how...
It's hard.
It is hard, but yeah, if I go to a forum...
Because you're not TV, you're not entertaining. No offense to you.
No,
but they will be introduced to Creative Commons when CNN says it's news. They'll accept it's news.
But then,
when CNN tells them that the cloud thing is a great thing, that's when they go online and say, oh, maybe we should try this cloud thing. And I think, like Stallman said, it's just media hype. He said it in 2008. And I still think a lot of people, they think it's a hip thing now to send your thing to this iCloud thing and to buy this Apple thing, the white thing, simple interface and GUIs and silverish thing and Aqua. And they really think it's what makes them friends, because that's what they see on TV. This is the guy who gets friends, the guy who dresses up hip, uses a Mac. And it really gets into them. And say, oh, you're such a Luddite, you don't put your data on the cloud. Say, no, because I'm not stupid. And they just look at people like that with ridicule, like, oh, Stallman doesn't use a cell phone, he must be crazy. Well, now we know he's not that crazy, and he doesn't pay with cash either.
Pays with cash. Yeah. I mean, I'm obviously talking to a limited audience within the remit of my Twitter followers and or people that are kind enough to read what I put onto Twitter. But, you know, with open source software, with Creative Commons, and with GNU/Linux, it just takes one person for me to, you know, show the benefits of and them to bring that into their own home, and that's a success. That person, and I've seen this happen before, I had a colleague at work, a computer user only because of necessity. He would use Facebook, he would send emails, just do basic stuff on his laptop. He was introduced to Linux on his laptop, and then next thing I know, he's recommended it to a friend, and that friend then comes to me and says, can you do the same thing to my computer?
Mm-hmm.
And although they don't know what they're running, and they don't know about, and they don't understand free and open source software, and to be fair, they don't have any interest in knowing what free and open
That's
source
okay.
software is. But it doesn't matter.
They don't have to understand it.
No. And the fact is that they're getting a better experience. So that's a success. Now, I could stand up in front of 50 people who've all got Linux already installed in the machine and say how great Linux is, for example, but I wouldn't be doing any good because they'd all be nodding their head to say, yeah, we know. So I try to sort of reach out, and that was why Diaspora wasn't what I wanted to do, because the people I want to reach to are the people that talk about Justin Bieber and Lady Gaga and don't consider that the thing that they're using to get onto the internet could be far better or a better experience with
a
Linux.
A lot of them are using Android now to do
and
that.
And that's good. And that's good.
And also when they serve the web, they're using this thing called Apache and Firefox and Chrome. So it is changing. But you see, they don't know what free software is. In fact, they will be told that open source is a failure and Linux is like, when will be the year of the Linux desktop? And they're really following, and that's fine, but at the end of the day, you thought, oh, this telephone you're using, that uses Linux, and this thing called Google, that runs Linux, and those websites they run in Apache, it's open source. They don't have to realize that they do this, but those things that they use will in some cases secure them from vulnerabilities, backdoors, and so on. By the way, I think Android is not that secure anymore, and I think the reason it's kind of permitted to be popularized is because based on the Wall Street Journal, a very pro-establishment thing, Android can have its facilities like cameras and microphones switched on remotely by the FBI. So we kind of know that there is some mechanism, and Google doesn't say anything about it. So in a way, you could say, okay, well, those people are using Android and it's free software. However, I'm not sure how we can count on it. And that also links into a recent report from the Free Software Foundation that the people working on Replicant. The guys working on Replicant with F-Droid, they found what they call to be a backdoor in the Samsung telephones. So the implementation of Android by some of the vendors will contain voluntary or involuntary backdoor inside of it that takes control of the phone, basically.
Yeah, I mean it's probably a subject that the mainstream consumer doesn't consider much until they see something in the paper. And they don't look at these.
But they
issues.
Do see it now.
Yeah, they do see it now. But I don't think you just have to look at the sales figures of Samsung, for example, to say that it's not really affecting the mindset of the mainstream consumer.
I don't know. Samsung's got okay perceptions.
Just as an example,
there are other issues now with Samsung doing imitating Apple, and I've listed recently about three or four things, anti-features that they have. They're going very hostile into the market of locking and region lockdown and DRM and disabling things remotely and a lot of bad things.
But then can you blame them, not in their actions, but why they're doing it? Because they're a business and they're making money and they've got shareholders and they've got board of directors. Yeah, and this is the way businesses operate. This is why the free software is a better model rather than big corporations controlling one product. Yeah, I mean, look at the Raspberry Pi. Can we ever envisage a time where the manufacturers of Raspberry Pi start producing their little components, encrypt DRM, and it would never happen. It's a computer that people can build and enjoy as a hobby, like computers used to be. It's the way big business works, and it's the same with bands as well. I know this is slightly a bad example, but if you look at a small band that starts off playing in the pub, they maybe sell a few of their own homemade records, then they'll go on to put some stuff on YouTube, and then they'll put some stuff out for free, a Creative Commons license or whatever. And then the second they get a contract with Sony or anybody like that, boom, that's it, they're gone. And they're producing completely different stuff and acting in a completely different way. I mean, just look at Metallica, for example. They were very different when they first started to being the pro-copyrights or I think that's my assessment, pro-copyright group that they are now. I think Lars Ulrich had a lot to say about piracy and copyright. I think he's a staunch supporter, in my opinion, of copyright.
Let me ask you a question. I was thinking this about a couple of hours ago. Since I was talking about labels, now, there's this label called pirate, okay? Now, obviously people who are copyright infringers are not pirates, and pirates did exist many years ago. And I read an article, and I don't mean like one of those edgy or marginalized sites, but a fairly good site, which was talking about the grievances of people in Somalia. Specifically, for those who want to read the article, I can provide a link. But the short story is there is dumping of nuclear waste there in the sea next to Somalia. If people look at the map, they'll see that it's an important passage point for those who are going through the Suez Canal. Now, the other thing that happens is they're taking all the fish, so ships from Europe and also from the United States are coming to pick up all the fish. And this, in part, is the cause of starvation, because they depend a lot on fishery. In Somalia, they don't have many green places from which to extract, like, you know, fauna and flora. So basically, let's say that they do have some potentially legitimate concern. Why do we call them pirates? I mean, if you look at how they operate, it's quite different from the way the pirates used to operate before. And so I think we should completely get rid of this notion of, you know, using the word pirate. It's become just a label now.
Yeah, I mean, it is. I mean, that's another human trait, isn't it, to put everything into a box and to give it a label. I mean, I can't speak much about Somali people that have been labeled a pirate. However, I think the title pirate for somebody who infringes copyright was something that was adopted by the pirates themselves. I think it was a title used by somebody like the Federation Against Copyright Theft many years ago to describe copyright infringement. I think the name became fashionable and it was adopted by the people committing copyright. Now it's become a sort of cool phrase to be associated with. I mean, Johnny Depp sort of that in the Pirates of the Caribbean. I think that's certainly why it's related to the copyright industry now. Certainly, I don't think anybody would say they were infringing copyright would take offence at being pirate. It's certainly not an offensive term.
Well, it depends who's talking. So when you use the word pirate, what you think of, your connotation and your mental association with the word will be different from another person's word. And I was reminded this when I expressed that in part, I'm a hacker. I'm hacking on code. I change code. And in fact, this is what I do in part for a living. And another person says the word hacker, and he kind of opens his eyes, like, what? You're a hacker? And I'm saying, yeah, but you probably don't know what the word actually means. And I know Stallman is extremely sensitive when I bring up the word hacker. He knows what he knows that I know what it means. However, he's concerned that some of the viewers will be confused by the word, and it's a legitimate concern.
This is something I can never understand. After my days of the Amiga, which was sort of the golden years for me for computing, the terms that we understood by hacker, coder, and cracker was the following. A coder was a programmer, wrote code. The hacker was somebody who broke into systems, brute forcing passwords or whatever. Days of the BBS, it was this thing. But that was what a hacker was, breaking the computer system, war games type thing. And then a cracker was somebody who took, say, one of the latest games and stuck a little intro on the front of it. And give you infinite life trainer. So that was the definition that I always understood those.
So the cracker will be the person downloading the thing, or the person who puts it available online with the cracks available?
The cracker would be the person who broke open the game, whatever it was, and stuck the infinite lives at the beginning so you could complete it.
And when these days they say pirates, do they mean the uploader or the downloader? Or both?
That's a very good question.
So a person who goes to YouTube, let's say Bill Gates, he admits doing that, and watches a copyrighted film, like Bill Gates does, is he a pirate?
I would suppose if you knowingly infringe the copyright of another, then regardless of whether you uploaded or downloaded, then you would come under the label of pirate, I assume.
Okay.
But that's a question I've never actually considered before. Who's the pirate, the uploader or the downloader?
So, saying that, okay, there was a report in an excellent website, Torrent Freak, I recommend to everybody, that says, I think, 37% of the people who are in the industry of asserting copyrights, whatever it is, I suppose they're looking at the very close circles to the MPAA, RAA, 37% of them, in fact, themselves are infringing. You know, by their definition, they are pirates. So here you have over a third of those who are pretending to be against the pirates, actually themselves being so-called pirates. And it's a very interesting story. However, if you're in the UK, and you and I had this discussion before, you might not be able to get to the site, because the UK is implementing a set of filters now for the children, of course. Adult children.
Yeah, you've got you.
Because, the government.
It's always an emotive word for the children, yes.
Yeah, for the children. It actually was passed for the children. It's not the children. It's true. And one of the sites to be censored by some of the ISPs, and one of them that's confirmed to be applicable in this case is Sky, is Torrent Freak. Because Torrent Freak is a very, very naughty site. It gives people news, and it gives a different point of view, and that's very, very dangerous. You know, think about the children. They might have a diverse point of view.
It's probably a good example of how, and I don't want to use the term ignorant, but not to know the mainstream consumers are, because the Pirate Bay has been subjected for many years now to blocks by the ISPs in the UK. And during that time, the Pirate Bay has still been running quite happily, because people in the know that you can go to it via a proxy. But the fact that they still keep these blocks in place, to me, shows that the mainstream users, and I wouldn't know if, I assume this Pirate Bay is still up and running, before I continue on and don't embarrass myself, but the mainstream user has been prevented by, this block, which is a really simple block, and can be circumvented with just a quick Google search, but it seems to have, well, certainly the people that I spoke with said they couldn't get access to the Pirate Bay. But having read Torrent Freak, it's still apparently still going. But there's plenty of ways you can get into it without even having any computer knowledge at all.
So maybe Torrent Freak is a gateway drug.
Yes, possibly.
It will lead people to, and then maybe the City of London also will just pull the main Torrent Freak at some stage, because they like to do it without any trial.
I challenged the Federation Against Software Theft on a tweet recently. They made some silly remark about copyright, and I challenged them back, and we had a very short conversation, yet they didn't respond. respond back to me on my final comments, and that was my novel's hopefully coming out soon. I'm not going to pimp it on here because I refuse to use this as an advertising tool, but I'll just say my book at the time is coming out very shortly. However, I'd be quite happy here and now, and people can hold me to this later, for people to pirate it. Why? Because I wrote the book for this specific reason, for people to read it and hopefully laugh at it, because it's a... So if somebody pirated it, I would take that as a compliment, and also the fact that people that do tend to pirate these things tend to be future customers and future people who say, yeah, I like his work, I've tried a bit of it for free, now I want to buy, you know, something of his.
But you're an author, you're a producer, mm-hmm. you're not a publisher, you're not the copyright monopoly or the copyright cartel or the copyright mm-hmm. whatever you want to call it. So these people are in the business of pretending to be businesses when all they actually do is try to assert a right to profit based on some bits or data or books or copies of books or something. And these, you know, there's all sorts of people that live in society and work, but they don't produce anything. They don't produce a real service. They don't produce any goods.
But they
justify their existence by all sorts of means. If you're in the CIA, you justify, say, we have terrorists. If you're in the banking industry, you say people need loans. If you're like a lawyer, you say, oh, people cannot represent themselves. They need me to help them out. So there are all sorts of things that you can argue are necessary, unnecessary. But in the case of the copyright industry, I think everyone who gets some of the facts will agree that they are like a parasite, and by doing a copyright reform, you can have all the artists equally happy, if not more happy, and you remove all those people from the loop. No, they won't be happy about that, because they are very, very wealthy individuals, the conglomerates, and to get rid of them will be very difficult, especially when they're literally contributing funds to the politicians in the UK and the US. So they have a lot of power, and it's really hard to, you know, dethrone them.
Maybe, and a debate for a future episode would be the bonuses. They're not in terms of ownership, but just in terms of the fact that the copyright issue gets nullified, and the benefits of being self-published. Because obviously, if you do self-publish, there's no sort of copyright cartel that can get involved in on behalf of a publisher or an agent that decides that somebody else has infringed your work. I was just sent to Gordon the other day, who does the Criven show. I'd be chuffed to bits. There's a big thing at the moment with authors about fan fiction and copyright infringements and stuff like that. And I was sent to Gordon on Twitter. It would probably be the biggest compliment I could have about my work if somebody wrote a piece of fan fiction about what the storyline to my book and continued on the story or adapted it in some way. For somebody to sit and take the time to write a novel in itself about something, you know, about your work, is probably about the biggest compliment you can get. It's very easy for somebody to say.
It's the same when. Some people set up several websites that whose only purpose was to attack my website. And I thought, wow, a whole person's dedicated his entire life just to talk about my website. That's great.
It is a compliment. Regardless of how they do it, of course it's not very pleasant when somebody sets up something that can be offensive and vulgar. But the ethos behind it and the fact that they've gone to the trouble to produce it means obviously that you're having an emotional effect. And I think I've said this on the show before. There's a very great man, and he was called Ric Flair. Well, he's still alive. He's called Ric Flair, and he was a wrestler in the WWE. And he said, to be loved is fine, to be hated is fine. It's gross indifference that's a killer. And I think that is so true.
You know what Kurt Cobain said? I saw a quote from him. I couldn't quote it precisely. It was in Diaspora. I said something along the lines of, to be hated for something you say is fine. To be loved for something you didn't say, i.e. misrepresentation, that's bad. So if people love you for things that you don't actually believe in, that's a bad thing. And I think people do need to be polite. I mean, it's very hard now to cause controversy. Just don't do anything, don't say anything, don't get involved, or be nothing, you know, don't say nothing, don't do anything. And it's easy, but this is why a lot of politicians get into, actually a lot of politicians don't actually say a thing. Now, the politicians who do say a lot in the States, and several of them are very interesting. I mean, Roy Wyden is very anti-surveillance, but he needs to come across as professional. In the US, no libertarian gets associated with like a bit of a freaky type of personality. And if you say you're a libertarian in the States, you get associated with one of the presidential candidates that's not so well known, or with one of those that tried to run with the GOP and his son. That's the Paul family. And that's what it means there to be a libertarian now. It's kind of like being a far-right kind of person, being very irrational, or at least that's the way the press represents that. But in any case, to be kind of controversial and outspoken now puts you under a whole new label. In the UK, we have people like George Galloway, and they will say negative things when people die, and the press, of course, will just jump on it and take advantage of that to say that person's crazy or the person doesn't accurately represent history. And sometimes I actually find it appealing when those people speak out, and the press attacking them makes me wonder, why is the press attacking them? Why are they not liked by the corporate press? Why are they not liked by the head of the corporations, the 1%? And when you start to explore it, you look at people like Bernie Sanders, I think he's in Vermont in the States. He's a very popular senator across the States because he really speaks out against the bankers, and he's not the only one.
But again, this is just something that humans have engaged in since the dawn of time. The Roman Empire had exactly the same things going on, albeit they didn't have technology and the internet and CCTV and all that, but they had informers, they had spies standing on street corners watching people reporting back on conversations. They had business that were in the ears of the local governors of areas, you know, where, and it's exactly the same, and history is just a complete repetition all the time. It's just now we have the facility to do things easier and quicker with the advent of technology. Yeah. But conversely, we also now have the facility to communicate our grievances with these techniques because of the technology itself. So people in the States who are in exactly the same position as everybody else in the world, you know, it's many, many people suffering intrusions by a few people in power and a few bodies associated with them.
And the enemy is, of course, the people who blow the whistle now. Let me tell you a few things. So Edward Snowden, very, very common target, usually the common propagandist to say he's a hero or a traitor, as if there is nothing in between. And it's the same smear they used against us. He's not a hero. Is a conscious person who decided to speak out. Now, here's an interesting thing I'll tell you. Snowden is, as you know, he's being portrayed as working for the Russians in the same way that Julian Assange was portrayed as it basically, they use all the same smears all over again, and you have to be familiar to know how it works. They tried to say that Snowden wasn't trying to hold people accountable inside the NSA. Now we know they lied, because he repeatedly shows evidence that he did speak to people inside the NSA, which, by the way, is not such a smart thing to do based on Thomas Drake, whose case he had studied before. And I know this because I was watching with my wife for an hour and a half an interview that Thomas Drake and Jesslyn Ruddock were doing in London Real just a few weeks ago, after Jesslyn was harassed in the border control in Heathrow. I think she was harassed by them. Now, here's a thing that you might not know, and I got it from the interview, and I think this was a new fact, having watched, you know, almost, you know, 5,000 articles about this whole spine, you know, apocalypse happening. What turns out to be the case, and I know WikiLeaks have been very quiet about it before for legal reasons, is when Snowden went from China to Russia, and people know that he did take the plane, he was actually in transit to go to South America. Now, he already had the tickets, it turned out, but then his passport was revoked by the States, and this is why he got stuck and couldn't board the plane. Now, a lot of people did not know they didn't board the plane because they actually revoked the passport while he was in Russia, therefore making him like a fugitive or a kind of imprisoned in the Russian airport in Moscow. So, and here again you have this situation where they would describe him as kind of a defector, as a person who went to Russia, when in fact he was in transit because he was trying to get to the real destination, which was South America, places that would grant him asylum, permanent asylum. And I just wanted to point this out since you were mentioning some of those things. I know the what I consider to be the British Snowden, that's Annie Machon and David Chaler, her husband at the time. She was also on London Real, and she's also connected with those other two people that I speak to on Twitter sometime. I speak with them. I never spoke to people like Snowden, but I spoke to a lot of people who are speaking to him on a regular basis. And what you might find is that all of those people have been thoroughly demonized, intimidated, and I know what they feel like because I also had some stories that I was reluctant to kind of talk about publicly, and I only speak about it privately with PGP encryption. And if people think that you have to really be a danger to the state, as in be a danger of physical harm or something, to be harassed, and then you just don't know enough. And a lot of those people are afraid to talk about it because they know that talking about it will have like serious consequences if they do that.
What I'd like to do, because I said before, I have to confess now to people listening to this. Hopefully, there's more than a few people listening. I've got a prior appointment with a soccer match that I haven't seen results to, that I've got taped that I really want to see, the Portland Timbers. So I'm going to be, was quite pushed on time. But if I could just finish this topic before we move on to a little bit of software, if that's okay with you, Roy. I would like just to mention this. In regards to all the allegations of information snooping and people's privacy exploited, I'm going to say something quite controversial, which everybody's going to probably say when they hear this. The public love it, and that's what they want. And I'll tell you why. People complain very quickly that their privacy was intruded upon with all this data that's been collected and all these webcams that have been viewed, etc., etc. But then you look at what's on the news at the moment. Currently we have the Pistorius trial running on, and that's exposing the private life of a gentleman who hasn't been found guilty or innocent yet, who's undergoing due process about a tragic killing, and obviously trying to get to the truth about what occurred and to deliver a verdict, either guilty or not guilty. Now, that's been put on public television, and his private life and the deceased's private life are being publicly exposed to worldwide TV. It's being run on Sky News, and I think a few other news services are running.
No, they're not news services.
Sorry? Well, yeah.
You can go into Because remember, those people have a lot of control over the press.
Yeah.
Also, the important point, remember who controls those CCTV footages. I mean, you and I don't have access to them.
But regardless of who's putting this on the television, people are lapping it up, and the general public are loving every minute of it. They're interested in the private lives of people. They want to know what these celebrities have been up to. This is not just the Pistorius trial. There's other celebrities. We wouldn't have tabloids in this country if there wasn't a market for the public's desire to know all the gory details about people's private lives. And it's a sad indictment of today's society where
wait, these people are products.
Yeah, but that doesn't make them any less. Yeah, that doesn't make them any less of a person in terms of their private life. For example,
you could have a society very different to football players. But if you idolize football players, if you idolize people who are politicians, if you idolize a lot of those people, people will respond to it. And there is a big industry called public relations, and they know how to do it. They know how to control people by brands, by names. They'll buy a perfume based on names. They'll buy things based on perceptions that they have and feelings that they have. They'll smoke because they saw some advertisement that says women are strong when they smoke. And this is how things work. So remember, these people their desires are a product of a process of indoctrination that starts quite early.
But then again, like I say, yeah, if I was the bearded, overweight version of Justin Bieber and I was selling hit singles, just because I'm in the public eye and just because obviously I'm relying on the public to give me an income, does that make me any less of a person and not protected by the privacy laws that the general public expect themselves to be protected by? I would have my as a celebrity. Now, fair enough. I know you say that you're going to say that the celebrities live off the fact that they promote themselves to the public and they'll show.
They don't promote them. They have agents, and their agents use them as products. So
But that doesn't make them any less of people in terms of their privacy. So, like when me being the bearded, overweight Justin Bieber sort of spends, I don't know, £25,000 on a new pair of shoes, and they want to put an article in the paper about it being a hideous waste of money. Is it right that just because I'm a celebrity, or that my privacy should be any less worth than, you know, John Smith who lives down the road who just goes to work every day and puts houses?
But wait, this violation of privacy is not done by the public sector, it's done by the private sector, by people like paparazzi and people who are surveilled.
But with the paparazzi, yeah, there has to be a market in order to fund it.
Yeah, and well, that's a privatized thing. Yeah. I don't think they do anything illegal. I might hate what they do, but I don't think it's illegal.
Yeah, and that's what I'm saying, is why about the British public, and all publics, I would expect, in every country, are the same with their desire to absorb all this private information. You know, when you see the likes of GCHQ intruding on people,
yeah,
it's still
an
invasion.
This is mass surveillance. You can't compare this to
look at it, it's raw value of being an intrusion of privacy. Because say your webcam was being watched by GCHQ. As far as you're concerned, you're not interested in everybody else that's being watched. You're concerned about your intrusion of privacy first and foremost.
I'm concerned. You know the ethos of what I'm saying.
You know, the first and foremost thing is that your privacy, and the most important thing is your privacy has been intruded upon, however they've done it.
Remember, you're being photographed, you're being surveilled, your phone being a tracking device, your payments going through SWIFT to the United States, which is a different country. That's not going to be used to defend you. In fact, that's always going to be used against you, if ever, because you have no access to CCTV. When my bicycle was stolen last year, for instance, I don't get to see the footage. They tell me what they see on the footage. When a relative of mine was a victim of a major scam, a very classic scam, and then I was actually very serious, speaking to the cops on her behalf because she was very emotional, and asked, why don't you ask GCHQ for, you know, the data? And says to me, no, we cannot use it in this case. In other words, the British police is happy to use this data when it comes to protecting banks and rich people, and I don't know what interests they put as priority. However, when they can use the data for something useful, and this is very important, they won't use it. They just won't use it because it's all about nepotism. Not with all of them, but a lot of the time. So they don't use it for positive purposes that could, you know, that they could actually use this data.
The caveat here to all of this, and this goes back to the very beginning of this conversation, where I propose that no matter what people campaign about, no matter how many petitions there are, things won't change, because there's one catch clause for all of this which protects the people that are in power and have access to these sorts of facilities to do monitoring, and that's one phrase, and it's in the interest of national security. Now, that catch-all can justify just about everything, used in conjunction with the T word, and they can just about pass anything they want, regardless of any laws that come out about privacy and things. And like I said before, you know, when you look at the GCHQ case, that was snooping by proxy. So whatever laws we had in this country, even if we had the strictest laws on privacy, and that no government body could ever intrude on somebody, on an individual's, you know, private life, it still wouldn't have made any difference, because we did it by proxy. We shared information with another country on our behalf.
I wrote about it. You know, in Yorkshire, do you know the hill in Yorkshire where they've been doing surveillance like this for even longer than GCHQ? And I've known about it for a while because a CIA a veteran professor, what's his name? He's deceased now, but his name was Chalmers Johnson. He spoke about it for years, how in Yorkshire there's basically this outpost of work for the NSA and intercepting all the emails coming out of Europe and beyond. So I've known about it, I've written about it even before the NSA leaks came out, years before, and this has been taken for granted. Like, if you don't encrypt the data, your emails, and if you think that they would have reasons to put you as a person of interest, they will read your emails. Like, literally, some of them will read your emails and trying to see what you say to your family. And that would induce self-censorship. Not because I'm doing something wrong, but because I don't want to, you know, dig into my entire private life. And what basically you have to bear in mind is that, as you said it, the public wants surveillance. I don't think anybody wants surveillance, not even for the neighbors. So I think it's a very catchy thing to say. It's like a kind of a man bites dog type of soundbite. and it will get your attention, but it's not actually true. The public doesn't want surveillance. Do you know who likes surveillance and who defends the NSA publicly? Bill Gates, for instance. Of course it does. But as a kid, does he mind being surveilled on? He knows he's idolized. He's in power, his friends are in power, he's friends with Obama, he's friends with all those people on top. They're defending each other against us. We're the enemy.
My opinion about the public's perception of CCTV on the whole, I'm not talking here now about intrusive CCTV, but I think that my opinion is the public thinks it wants CCTV, which is very different to wanting CCTV. The CCTV has been built up a sort of legend in its own time of being the ultimate deterrent for criminals. And like I said earlier on, nobody can ever produce stats for things that have been prevented as a result of CCTV being present. Burglar that went out, saw a camera, thought, no, I'm not going to burgle a house today. That can never be measured. It can never be put into a chart. And so the public will accept that because this can't be measured and because they haven't been burgled or there's been fewer burglaries in the area or maybe no burglaries in that particular area, then they'll accept that CCTV is this great, great device. Now, I must admit, my personal view, and I said this on my website many years ago, and I have to talk personally now. If my mother was walking home on a lonely, on a darkened street by herself, I would feel more secure, rightly or wrongly, with a camera, with a CCTV operator sitting in an office somewhere, following her on camera. Now, whether that's right or wrong, whether that's me misinterpreting, how good CCTV cameras are, but I would say I'd feel better with that camera there than it not being there at all. Whether it could do any good, that's up for debate, but it would give me more reassurance having it than not having it. That's my personal view.
It's not for free, you're paying for it.
No, of course we are. And if you look on shops, people say about the cameras in shops and stores and things, and it's very different in a store. It's a condition of entry. And I've tried to explain this to many people who are against cameras in stores. Once you walk through that door, the reason why they have all the signs on the door saying CCTV in operation in this store is because it's a condition of entry. Once you enter that store, you are knowingly entering a store with CCTV. If you don't like the fact that CCTV in the store, you don't go into it. It's very similar to a passport control. When you go to an airport, you'll hand your passport in and get all the business done, and you accept that you have to walk through a scanner and be x-rayed and have your bags looked at. If you don't like that, you don't go in, because if you go into the airport and say, no, I'm not going to be scanned today, I'm not going to let you
in. Do they still do it?
Sorry?
In London, do they still do it down there? X-ray. Manchester. They stopped it in Manchester.
I was just giving an example. I don't know. Yeah. I was just giving an example. But you know, your bags.
It's against the European.
And here's.
Commissioner in Parliament.
Here's another one for you. Here's another one for you as well, which is probably the best example of all, condition of entry. When you're walking down the street, if you're stopped by another member of public and they ask you to turn out your pockets and search you because they think you've got a weapon on you, you can rightfully say, no, I'm not going to do anything. The citizens' powers that you have, or common law powers that you have, don't allow you to do that. However, if you enter a football ground, you're entering with a condition of entry, and that condition of entry says that a steward, who is not a warranted officer or has any sort of warrant at all, is allowed to search you and turn out your pockets and make sure you don't have a weapon, because you've entered a premises with the strict knowledge that there's you can be searched by their stewards. If you don't want to be searched, you get chucked out, or you're not allowed entry in the first place. And that's why it's very different when you enter stores or enter football grounds or whatever. And people don't seem to realize this. You can have a condition of entry in your house that says that.
Does it have to be a close premise? For instance, here in Manchester, I think there are certain rules when you enter this place called. So it can be like the so-called private property, as they like to call it. So places like Springfields here in Manchester, which is like a kind of a precinct of banks and shops and stuff. So that kind of expands to everywhere, and they can confuse you and they can trick you into thinking that you stand in a so-called public, so-called private property or a private area, and then have you concede and
it's,
trick you into it.
So. I mean, it's very. I would hope. Well, I wouldn't hope. I would say that there'll be very few places where people will physically put hands on other people without the backing of law, because of the fact that in this day and age, there's so many court cases, so many people willing to take cases to court. It could be construed as assault. there's various facets of crime it could constitute if somebody's unlawfully searched or roughed up by somebody who doesn't have the power in law. Conditions of entry are very restrictive as well. I've got haste to add, you can't, I wouldn't expect if you entered John Lewis on a condition of entry that there'll be any sort of caveat in there that says people can search intimately or anything like that. So there is a limit on that condition of entry, in that it would have to be have some sort of reasonableness. For example, CCTV cameras operate in this store. We do prosecute shoplifters, or whatever they say. Obviously, they're not allowed to put them into toilets and things like that. And they do follow very strict rules, as I was saying earlier, with the camera and privacy and keeping it within certain set of boundaries.
They don't have to put it in the toilets because people carry their camera inside the toilets. And very often these are just people's phones and they don't realize this thing can be remotely enabled.
I'll go on.
I'm not joking, I'm serious. I mean, people carry phones and cameras to a lot of places that they shouldn't be in. And they don't think about it.
I'll go on record now and say that I don't believe there is a single store in the UK that would ever have a camera in the toilet. A store or a pub or anything like that.
No, I mean the intelligence services people carry, yeah, and they can remotely enable people's cameras, and we know how they do it now. I think it's been since our last major show that it turned out that indeed phones come with two operating systems. One operating system can take over the other one. Several companies refuse to talk about it. They don't deny it, but they refuse to talk about it. And once the other operating system takes over the main one, it can do just about anything. And this can be done by the tower, so as long as you're connected, you're not only being tracked, but the tracking outposts or the antennas have the capability of sending signals to transmit from your phone as though it was just a bugging device.
But again, Roy, I completely agree with the tracking of phones. It's a utility now, or a technology which is available, which people can be tracking real time. They can find out how long they spend at McDonald's or how long they spent in the library or whatever. However, these facilities to track have, again, been available for years. So, for example, your debit card is probably more revealing about your personality than your phone is. In terms of
I'm not talking about metadata or so-called metadata, which probably actually tells. This reveals a lot more about you. The metadata is kind of like a processed summary, a profile of who you talk to and how you talk. But wait, let's clarify. When I say they take over your phone, I mean they listen to you constantly. It's not very bad for the battery of the phone, obviously, but they listen to your conversation in the house. It's like having a microphone inside your house. Basically, we also know now that GCHQ was planning to take over the camera of the Kinect or the Xbox One. We also know that they listen to conversations in Xbox Live. That's conversations that are happening in textual forms. We know more about Skype. We know about Yahoo Chat. And when it comes to surveillance inside people's homes, we know about various other ways in which they completely take over devices and then turn them into surveillance devices right inside your house. So any person who thought that was, a movie plot or a very pessimistic view on the future, no, it's not the future, it's here. And they don't just use it against people or a threat, but they use it against... did you hear about Julian Assange in the embassy? They found a bugging device inside the embassy?
Yes,
it's quite interesting how it got there.
However, what would just add sort of as a final point, and it sort of relates back to the point I made about conditions of entry. You've agreed to this surveillance, Roy, and so have I, and so has everybody else who's listening to this. If you read, for example, let's look at the very basic level, or the ground level, your ISP itself, have a look in your terms and conditions. I think you'll find on one of the points there, there's already a clause which you've signed digitally in that you've accepted the contract on the basis of this clause, that they will share data with associated bodies, government bodies, law enforcement, in the prevention and detection of crime. It's in every single ISP contract I've ever read, and we've already signed up to it. So really, look at it and be very sort of partial and neutral here and just look at it as an outsider. People have already signed and agreed to it. Because the condition of entry to use your ISP, wherever it is, Sky, I'm currently on Sky, is already that they will share data, or share your data, with agencies in the prevention and detection of crime. There we are. So, regardless of, you know, sort of the ethical issues of opening up camera phones and opening up webcams or whatever, people have already agreed to it. They've walked through the doors of the football ground metaphorically and allowed.
Were they given a choice?
No.
The choice is either don't use it or use it.
Yeah.
It's a real issue.
Yeah,
it's a real
issue. Not, I mean, that's life itself. For example, if you come around my house and I say to you, right, I'm selling some apples off my tree. They're a pound an apple. You say to me, no, I don't want to buy them. They're too expensive. Or you can pay a pound an apple. It's a condition of entry. It's a purchase. It's a whatever. But it's a contract that you've signed or agreed to because of your by nature of use. And it's something that I keep reiterating to people. You can argue about the ethical behavior or unethical
but
behavior.
Having said that, sometimes the ISP don't keep up with the... I mean, currently the Open Rights Group in the UK, ORG, they're trying to ensure that there is compliance and conformance among the ISPs with laws that have been passed to Europe regarding data protection. So, there is the concern that the ISPs are not keeping up with what's the regulation.
And they can't, you see, Roy, because this is a problem. Say, for example, they were to remove this clause that says, yeah, there would be, you know, shared data in prevention and detection of crime. And again, national security, interest in national security in the T word, people can get whatever they want. If they didn't have that clause there, it wouldn't matter because any sort of government body can go to a court and get a warrant, very, very simply, and ask for this information. Now, the ISP then, when it's presented with a court warrant, can either give over the information, or they can be then liable for arrest, and they commit the crime, and the data is still taken anyway. People fail to grasp that you will never have your privacy, and you will never be private. Obviously, if you engage in encrypting your data, that's a different matter. And I wouldn't like to say about the different strengths, as it were, of the encryption packages out there, because I don't know. I've never personally used encryption before. But there's always a way to get this data.
Everybody uses encryption to some degree.
Well, yeah.
If you do financial transactions.
But I'm talking about the people who intentionally will use PGP is one that comes to mind. I have
that's encryption for one specific protocol. That's email transmission.
Yeah.
But people use, if you've paid online, if you've accessed your BT bill online or something, you are using encryption. Whether it's good encryption or whether the NSA has got backdoor to it, that's a different kind of question.
Well, you take it that it's encryption. I mean, most people will take it on good faith that when they put their password into whatever site they're getting into, that it's encrypted in some way to prevent other people from using it. The site says it is, and when you enter your card details to make a purchase, it says it's secure. But does the average user know that it's secure? No, they just take it on good faith. It may well be secure, and it may well be sort of watertight. But again, like I say, the mainstream consumer doesn't have the interest or the understanding to follow these issues properly. One thing I can just say, just remind me very quickly. I saw something very interesting recently, and I can't remember where I saw it, but it was somebody in government who was talking about encrypting of data and privacy and things like that, and he implies that by encrypting your data and making attempts to protect your privacy, you would have the eye of suspicion sort of pointed at you because you were the one using encryption, and oh, what's he up to? He must have something to hide. And I thought that was very interesting because obviously it means that now they've got a concern that people are starting to care about the privacy.
The NSA keeps encrypted messages in particular. You'd think they'd throw them away because they cannot decrypt them, but it's quite the opposite. If you encrypt your data, they will keep it for longer in case that, one, they will have the computing power to do that, maybe a quantum computer, or two, they will find a flaw that will allow them to then decrypt the messages. So basically, you are flagging yourself more so, but it doesn't necessarily mean they can read what you wrote.
I personally think for the UK, in any case, as far as my personal opinion of the UK is, that was a scare tactic because the government is concerned that people would start wanting their privacy, which is not an unreasonable thing to want. I mean, I wouldn't bother with encryption. It's not really an issue for me. I'm not going to encrypt my files or anything like that, or put files onto Google Drive that are encrypted with PGP or whatever. What I would say was it seemed more of a scare tactic, and it's a very sad state of affairs that people would have to feel that if they do want to encrypt, there might be genuine reasons as well. For example, my book, if I had copyright concerns that somebody was going to steal my great idea, and I put great in quotes, then I might encrypt my book in its current format and put it on a Google Drive. There's nothing untoward in that book. It purely is the fact that I don't want somebody stealing it. I have a concern. But then
nobody can steal it, don't worry. Unless they can delete
It's just an example. But if I could just say, there's something very worrying starting to happen now, and I don't know a lot about this. I've been trying to find some more information on it by searching it, but there's very, very little detail. It seems that now there's a law, and I'm not sure which act it comes under, but it appears that not supplying a password for an encrypted file or similar is an offence in some shape or form.
Where? Now, the question is where?
There was a case.
In the States? Or
no, in the UK.
UK.
In the UK. It came as a result of, I believe, a SOCPA arrest that came, was on television.
A USB, a guy who had his USB key.
I think he refused to give his password, mm-hmm. and then because of that, which beggars belief if he'd forgotten the password, which we all do. But he refused to give his password, and there was some other charge levied against him. And I mean, this was what I read. I don't know this. I don't know any more than that. So I was sort of.
He's allowed to refuse. The law in the UK is different from the US. Usually they eventually converge, but currently it's different. It depends on the states as well, which state as well. There is a bunch of cases in the states. It also, I think, depends on the allegations that's leveled against you, and if they have other evidence. The other thing they try and do is to crack the encryption or to figure out the headers of some of the files so that they have a reasonable suspicion to then say, oh, look, we can see that the file names, they look a bit suspicious. However, I think that this idea that they should have access to all the data and encryption misses the point that sometimes they go to the supplier. In the case of Lovebit, they would go to the person transmitting your mail and decrypting it for you, and they would then force them to give the SSL keys or the encryption keys so they can read your email. So there is also the man in the middle.
Can you remember this case I'm talking about? I mean, it was about a year ago, I think.
What, in the UK?
Yeah, I'm sure.
Said recently. I think it's still ongoing, to be honest.
Oh, is it? Yeah, because I just can't find any more information on it. Because I was very interested, obviously, as you know, I have a little bit of a law background.
I posted at least a couple of links to it in TechWrite at some stage, but I think I don't think it was the major scandal was just the fact that they want him to give the password. I don't know if he was arrested for something else. There might be some unruly conduct of the resulting at the scene. You know, him cursing at a cop, and then the cop said, "Oh, that's horrible. I'm just going to show you. I'll find something against you," and they find something, and they maybe make something up. Of course, I have a friend who works in the Arundel Center, and he works in security, and now they have this new thing where as they walk, instead of having like a nice tie or something, they've got like a camera sticking at you, and it says something along the lines of "Smile, you're being watched." Of course, he doesn't choose to wear it, but his bosses have a monopoly on the footage. Of course, he cannot go there, and this, the way they sell it to him is like, wear this, it will protect you, or it will support you, and whatever, you know. Obviously not supporting the public. Whoever controls the camera decides what evidence to divulge. And you maybe with a freedom of information request, if you're very legally savvy, maybe you'd be able to get the footage and request it by law. I hereby require that you give me the footage, and they might give it to you. There's an interesting footage in Texas coming out becoming viral on YouTube of a guy who really tried hard to get the footage from the police of an incident that happened where the police was overstepping its authority. But the fact of the matter is, with all of these cases where you have a camera, when you have footage, you have to remember who's got access to it, because that's the person who's in power. That's the person who really has the plot and can provide proof and deny proof if he or she doesn't feel like giving it. You know, and GCHQ is a great example of a monopoly on the data. They know everything about everyone. They know who you talk to, they know what you talk about, they can listen to you, they can do anything. But you have no access to this data, you have no access, it's not a backup of your data. It's just something that can always be leveled and used against every potential politician, every potential dissident, every protest organizer, and it'll find something on you. It's not just copyright infringement claims, it'll be something more severe, so they can put some big headline in the news that will destroy your reputation, and they do that. They leak it to the media. This is why it's such a big deal that they have the Angela Merkel's file, and they refuse now to give it to her. They just say, just trust us, we stopped spying on you now. But we're not going to show you your dossier, basically. There were scandals before, even in the days of WikiLeaks, when they divulged the data showing that they were spying on Argentinian leaders and using it to smear them and to basically go into the private lives of people. But completely for political reasons, but nothing to do with security.
I'm surprised Ms. Merkel, in the example you just gave, I mean, it is a pretty pointless exercise. If she requests data, you know, that they collected on her, I mean, these people are willing to, you know, intrude on yours, mine, and her, in this case, privacy. They're willing to overstep the mark as what's classed as acceptable and decent in terms of intrusion. So what's to say when they receive that the Freedom of Information request to give the dossier over, that is only going to be partially complete? I mean, who is watching them? Because there is nobody higher than them who watches those type of people. And this is a problem we've got. And I wish I could remember who made the comment, who watches the watchers, or something similar like that. Because it's very, very true. They are at the top peer or top tier of the, you know, surveillance. And there's nobody that they account to. So what about their actions? And that's what
and, and now there is a big debate in the States over this, but actually in the context of torture. Now, I should mention, now there is a new report, I think it's a Sunday Tap report, a major one of those, you know, big scandals revealed on Sunday. And it's complicity of Britain in the torture by the CIA in a remote island somewhere. So, you know, the CIA has got this thing, it's called black sites, torture sites, in different countries such as Poland, I think Lithuania, we know about Lithuania. And now one of, I suppose it's one of the islands colonized by the UK, is being used also as one of those sites. And the point is, the CIA is now under a lot of attack for torture, and the major issue is when the Senate in the US is accusing the CIA of overstepping their rights, their authority, whatever, in doing torture, which doesn't bring any real benefit and doesn't produce any real, you know, evidence. Torture is very good to intimidate people or to punish people. It's not very good at producing evidence because people just say whatever it takes to stop the suffering. So it's not, it's just not the right tool for extracting evidence. And now that the Senate says that the CIA is, you know, showing that the CIA is completely corrupt, the CIA is retaliating specifically against the group and the team or the office, whatever, of Dianne Feinstein, who's a thing is senator in California. And she comes out complaining that they are trying to destroy her because she's willing to tell the public what they're doing. And this is a great example of not in the case of surveillance, but human rights violations, where the CIA is not accountable to anyone. And if the Senate tries to hold them accountable, then Senate is suffering retribution, very serious, scary steps. Nancy Pelosi, I think she's former now spokesman for the White House, she says openly, like, we, the politicians, we're afraid of the CIA. We are literally afraid of them. So who's in charge now? And here in the UK, GCHQ, through the United States, spies and British politicians. So what if you were a British politician, would you really be willing to take on the GCHQ knowing that they got everything about you? And only the people themselves, they know what they have to hide. They know every person's got something to hide or something that he or she would rather not be public. There's something that can be at the very least somewhat harmful to the career. So they know that these people have got a lot of power. So, of course, they're not going to be challenged by, especially here in the UK, I think surveillance, the criticism against surveillance has been very weak compared to some of the groups that you see in the States that really go out publicly against it. Well, I've not seen any protest here.
What I'm going to suggest now is that this discussion about privacy and GCHQ and all the other facets of that has taken up most of the show. Mm-hmm. I have an appointment, and I suggest we split this into two carry this on maybe tomorrow or Tuesday.
Okay.
Bye, Roy. It's been very, very interesting. It's been a great return for me, I must say, because, like I say, after being out for a year, I thought I'd be a little rusty and it wouldn't feel as normal as it was when myself and Roy were doing it every couple of days. It's been an absolute pleasure to do it again. So what I suggest, I go off and watch my Portland Timbers, hopefully win. You go off and kindly do all the encoding and the hard work, which I hasten to add for people listening. Roy does all the hard work for this. I'll just talk a bit on the microphone, give you the pleasure of my dulcet tones, and then leave it to Roy to get up onto the web. So thank you very much, Roy. And we continue this either tomorrow or Tuesday, depending on who is what your timetable is like.
Yes, hopefully we will do it on a regular basis.
Yes.
The one thing I said we should cover is this whole issue of surveillance. A lot has been happening, and we've covered quite a few things today, and we didn't really touch any of the GNU Linux free software things quite as much as we could have, but we can leave it for the next shows and try to do a kind of a roundup of the past few months or year worth of news. So, yeah.
Right, well, thank you everybody for listening. I know it's probably been a while that you've heard me, probably if you listen to this audio cast for any period of time. So for the people that have picked up recently in his audio cast, I apologise, you've had to suffer my tones as well. Look forward to you downloading it again. Thank you very much, Roy, for having me back. And we'll speak again in the next couple of days and hopefully have another episode released.
It's Friday night and I'm gonna get sauce. I fought the troll and the troll lost. I fought the troll and the troll lost. He tried to boss me and was outbossed. I fought the troll and the troll lost. I fought the troll and the troll lost. Underneath his creeper bridge, hoping goats will cross. Quoting Ashcroft and Tom Ridge, I fought the troll and the troll lost. I fought the troll and the troll lost. He's even dumber than Mickey Koss. I fought the troll and the troll lost. I fought the troll and the troll lost. Wouldn't last 2 minutes with David Frost. I fought the troll and the troll lost. I fought the troll and the troll lost. His worldview sounds like pro wrestling, although not as nuanced. Behind his eyes the wind's whistling. I fought the troll and the troll lost. I fought the troll and the troll lost. I kicked him off a Pentagon and Atrios. I fought the troll and the troll lost. I fought the troll and the troll lost. He's permanently banned from daily costs. I fought the troll and the troll lost. I fought the troll and the troll lost. And in November, W and all his thugs will toss. We'll try to fix America. I fought the troll and the troll lost. I fought the troll and the troll lost.
And all you trolls out there trying to aggravate everyone with your stupidity, illogic, and blind, unthinking devotion to the Bush regime, this section is especially for you. I'm not going to name any of you out loud, not wanting to give you even the slightest possible notoriety, but as you sink under the weight of your own asininity into an intellectual La Brea tar pit, you can imagine that I sing your nom de guerre right now and bask in a stolen fame you don't deserve.